Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Mr. Khosa at 7 o'clock. Right now on this day, we start in 1912. Montenegro would declare war against modern-day Turkey. This would be the start of the Balkan War. 1934 on this day, Kara Asmal would be born. In 1945 on this day, a gentleman by the name of Percy Spencer would patent the microwave in the US. 1962 on this day, North Korea would have its best election result ever with 100% voter turnout and 100% of the voters voting for the Workers' Party. In 1967 on this day, Che Guevara would be captured in Bolivia. In 1972 on this day, Emerson Fittipaldi would be the first Brazilian to become a Formula One champion. In 1978, on the exact same day, Mario Andretti would finish 10th but still win his first Formula One title as well. 1992 on this day, Mortal Kombat would be released for the first time in 2D. Thank you to Midway Games for that. In 2000, Michael Schumacher would win his third title. This would be the start of the first of five consecutive titles he would win as Formula One a champion. And in 2004 on this day, Martha Stewart would officially earn her stripes, quite literally starting her jail term on this day for insider trading and obstruction of justice. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And on the show today, we take a look at the latest developments out of China and Europe. It looks as though China is retaliating to Europe's EV tariffs with their own tariffs on brandy. Then we have a conversation with Jan Vermeulen of My Broadband around technical insolvencies. There's a couple of companies going through it. We're going to understand what it is and what it means for those companies. Then we've got a conversation with Luno around their latest partnership with Zappa. They announced that they're partnering with Zappa, and that now means you and I as citizens can pay for our groceries, amongst other things, using crypto. And then because it's Tuesday, we've got a Agri segment on this Tuesday. It's not Property Tuesday, it's Agri Tuesday. We're going to be taking a look at the anti-venom production in South Africa coming to a standstill. We've got a conversation with the African Snakebite Institute on why that matters to us.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As always, we kick off with how the markets have been moving throughout the day. It's certainly been an interesting day of movements with China coming back from that golden week of holiday that they had. I'm joined on the line by Chantal Marx, Head of Research at F&B Wealth and Investments, to take a look at these and other movements. Good evening, Chantal. Lovely to speak to you as always. Let's start with Asian markets. Let's start with the Chinese story. Chinese markets coming back to the party. Hong Kong not having a good day.
No, not at all. It seems as investors in the region were not happy with very few details about on proposed fiscal stimulus measures in that country. So last week we had the China authorities saying that they're going to do quite a lot to boost economic growth in China, starting with policy, so that is whatever the central bank can do, but then also saying that they're going to introduce a wide range of fiscal measures, so state funding, in order to boost economic growth. And it does seem as if the latest kind of utterances from authorities in China has been high confidence that they'll be able to do enough.
Sorry about that, Chantal. We seem to have a very bad line to you. I'm going to send you back to Cal, our producer. We're going to see if we can get you back on a better line. In the meantime, the gold price isn't doing much. I'll give you an update on that. It briefly came all the way down to $2,605 an ounce. I bring that up because it is the lowest we've seen it. It's lost about 1% today. Hasn't been at these levels in quite some time. In fact, the last time we were probably around this level, I will see, pull up one of my charts. The last time we were around this level was probably around September, and it seems we've got Chantal back, and we'll get into that in a little bit, but let's finish with the China story. Chantal, are you back with us?
Yes, I am back with you.
Ooh, I'm much better.
I'm not sure how much you heard from what I said earlier, but basically the point is that that investors were underwhelmed by what authorities have been saying in terms of fiscal spending, so state support for the economy. They've said that they're going to do a whole lot on the monetary policy side, so from the central bank side, and that seems to be coming through. But in terms of state intervention and state-funded growth or state-funded growth growth push from their side, it does seem as if it's not enough to convince investors that it will result in sustainable growth in the Chinese economy. So we saw stock prices move back quite heavily on the Chinese mainland and in Hong Kong, really, today. And that filtered through to the JSE as well, with, I see, Naspers and Prosus being sold off heavily and commodity stocks coming under a lot of pressure because, of course, our commodity prices are very dependent on Chinese economic growth.
Chantal, when we look at our own picture, as you said, commodities and resource counters coming off, but it wasn't much better from industrials. I think financials were the only real sector that, and finishing flat is not really much of an achievement, but it is compared to how negative the others are. Is the sentiment going around? Because I'm looking at European markets as well. They didn't fare much better. The only markets that seem to be in the green are US markets.
Yes, absolutely. So I think that this sentiment is filtering through. I think that there's also not a lot of data at the moment that's really giving investors clarity in terms of a way forward. It's been quiet so far on the data front. We do see that picking up tomorrow and going into Thursday with some US data releases coming through. And I think that there's a lot of risk out there. Investors are nervous about the Chinese situation. When Chinese investors panic and when there's panic around Chinese stocks right now, it's difficult to see where that kind of optimism is going to come from, where the economic growth for the next year is going to come from. And it makes investors nervous. And that coupled with a major unrest in the Middle East and political risk in the US, it's freaking investors out. I guess on the US front, things looked a little bit different because there was a reasonable bid in the Magnificent Seven. So after those stocks were sold off quite heavily over the last few weeks, we have seen some interest return again because these stocks are now priced a little bit more fairly, and that really pushing up the market over there.
Chantal, let's have a quick look at gold. The gold price, again, with the risk sentiment seemingly going against risk at the moment, you'd think the gold price would be doing well, but it's down to levels we haven't seen since sort of mid-September earlier this year.
Yes, so I think that there are a couple of things that are having an impact on gold at the moment. So you would think that it would be at sustained higher levels because of the geopolitical issues that we're facing globally at the moment. And over a one-month period, it is still up around about 6%, and over 3 months, around about 12%. But we have seen some weakness lately, and I think today in particular was quite weak. And that could be a combination of a stronger US dollar. A weaker US dollar tends to be quite positive for gold, and of course the inverse is true as well. And then one must remember that gold is a safe haven asset, but it's also an important there's an important component of demand coming through from jewelry. And China is one of the biggest jewelry markets in the world, and when there's negativity around that market, it could filter through into the expectations for gold demand over the next year or so.
Chantal, I saw something interesting that suggests that US dollar reserves are the lowest they've been in quite some time, and that China has increased its buy up of gold, buying up some 225 tons or so in the last little while. Is this a clearer shift around some underlying things that could potentially play themselves out into the markets in years to come in a very different form? Or is this just markets potentially repositioning ahead of a US election?
Yeah, so I mean, this is something that we've been seeing over the last 2.5 years or so, at least since Russia invaded Ukraine and Russian sanctions were imposed. The Russians really struggled because they had a lot of US dollar reserves that they could do absolutely nothing with. And I think other central banks were cautious because of that. So we have seen central bank buying generally pick up quite a bit, Chinese central bank buying in particular over the last 2.5 years. And it's been one of the reasons why we've liked gold as an asset class. Remember, the situation or the relationship between China and the US isn't necessarily a friendly one. And from a reserves perspective, I would think that they would feel more comfortable holding a lot more gold and a lot less US dollars.
That certainly makes a lot of sense. Sticking with the U.S. picture for a second, you mentioned a little earlier that we've got some data points coming out of the U.S. I know U.S. inflation is set to come out, I think it's tomorrow, Thursday. Are we expecting that that will have a material impact on the market? I mean, the Fed chair, Jerome Powell, has already made it very clear that the Fed will not be bullied into rate cuts and they'll make rate cuts decisions on their own. Do we expect tomorrow's inflation print to have a real bearing on how the Fed sees the rate cutting cycle?
So I guess it depends on how far away it is from it, from what is expected currently. So currently the expectation is for headline inflation to slow from 2.5% year-on-year to 2.3% year-on-year. If there is a big undershoot, it could open the door for the Fed to cut rates or to cut rates by more than expected. At this point in time, it's 25 basis points in November and 25 basis points in December. So if it's lower than expected, it does give them room to do that. If it's higher than expected, then I don't think we'll see another 50 basis point cut. I think that the expectation will then be for kind of a smoother 25 basis point rate cut in November, December, and then going into the next few meetings in 2025.
Chantal, what are you looking forward to in 2025? I mean, obviously the US elections are less than a month away. That's got sentiment moving around like crazy. When the dust settles, regardless of what the outcome is, and perhaps the outcome is important to 2025, what do we look at towards the end of the year or going into next year? What are some of the areas that seem to make sense?
So I think going into 2025, we certainly will have a very important election year behind us. So not only in the US, not only in South Africa, but half of the world population, more than half of the world population were at the polls this 2024, or would have been in 2024. So there was a lot of political risk in this specific year. I think going into 2025, it'll probably be less so. And hopefully we can benefit from some of the cyclical tailwinds that we're already seeing coming through now in the fourth quarter. Lower interest rates, lower inflation, higher consumer confidence, higher consumer disposable income. In the South African context, hopefully a continuation of structural reform, hopefully an improvement on the logistics side, and long may load shedding stay away. So I think it could be a really good year from an asset price perspective, and I think it could be a particularly good year for South African asset prices.
What about international prices? What about the Asian markets and European markets? I mean, clearly we're seeing that this could be the start of a lot more turmoil to come between those relationships, but we also don't know when the Middle East tensions are going to de-escalate.
So, I mean, those macroeconomic tailwinds that I'm speaking about will be quite prevalent not only in South Africa, but in the US and Europe as well. I think from a US perspective, the only issue is that asset prices are quite high, so the market is quite expensive. So that might limit the kind of returns that you get from US assets. That said, I mean, we have seen this kind of rally that has been coming through in US stocks over the last few years being fueled by very few stocks. So perhaps a broader stock market recovery, maybe the small and mid-cap space faring a little bit better. In Europe, I think that there are a lot of quality assets that aren't too expensive at the moment, but we are a little bit concerned that European growth might be more structurally constrained, so issues in that economy resulting in lower growth. But still, I think that there are a lot of opportunities there. And in China, I think it depends on whether or not the stimulus measures that they put in place is enough to meaningfully lift economic growth projections from below 4% to at least 5%. The stock market there isn't expensive, even though we've seen a big rally in those stocks over the last week or so, with the exception of today, of course. But those stocks are not expensive, and I think that they could get a really good bid and do quite well for investors. But I think that most of my excitement at the moment actually lies domestically.
It's all green for the domestic market. Hopefully that does continue. Hopefully we do recover from some of these retracements and we continue with the bullish momentum we started to see. Thank you so much, Chantal. We'll leave it at that. Thanks as always for the time and for the insights. Chantal Marks, Head of Research at F&B Wealth and Investments, on what's been moving the markets and what could potentially move them going forward.
And in your business news, Reserve Bank Governor, what's his name, has repeatedly said this and that, and policymakers are expecting rates to go up or down. With inflation somewhere between 0 and 100%, interest rate relief may come sooner or later. Who knows, really? The whatchamacallit slid into undefined territory based on the Dohiki being so-so, and the markets were hard to describe. Despite initial doubts, the outcome was a mixed bag. The rand was meh based on the US consumer prices, but sentiment towards the currency could be, you know, whatever.
You can't base a decision on imprecision. Ask your financial advisor about a guaranteed annuity from Momentum Wealth. Personalized certainty.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We pick up on that story with China retaliating in some form to the EU's announcement of EV tariffs. I'm joined on the line by Johan Els, chief economist at Old Mutual, to take a look at this and try and make sense of it. Good evening, Johan. Lovely to speak to you as always. Let's start with understanding the EU's rationale for imposing the tariffs in the first place.
Hi, good evening. Yeah, it's weird that the EU is at the forefront of the green theme that they want to halt cheap imports from China. And I suppose it's protectionism because they perhaps can't produce EV as cheap as China can. But still, it's spiting your own nose because we want everybody to move away from petrol cars and diesel cars towards electrical vehicles. So it's not a good move. And of course, as you say, China retaliating. So this is a trade war starting up, and it's never good for anybody.
Well, China's response to that was that they are protecting their own sector from dumping. And I suppose the question there is their sector really that big, or is this a diplomatic way of them saying, we're happy to go to war if you guys want to?
My understanding is that their sector isn't that big at all. While some of the affluent Chinese like French brandy, I think that's just a way of rather undiplomatically saying, you know, if you're going to put large tariffs on imports from us, we're going to retaliate. And so I think that's what's happening here. And so, yeah, everybody's protecting their own. And you know what? What's going to happen is that consumers are going to suffer because prices are going to go up, and we're not going to get the end result that we ideally need in terms of environmentally friendly vehicles.
Consumers suffering is one thing, Johan. The other one that I picked up on when I was thinking about who's likely to be most hurt by this was LVMH. The owners of Hennessy, as well as Remy Martin, the French cognac company, the share prices of those two companies alone were in the red just off the back of this announcement. So clearly, they're not going to be happy with this news. I imagine they're not going to be happy with China's response. And there's very little they can do about it, I suppose, other than petition the EU.
And I suppose that's what we'll see now. The lobbying will start to petition the EU, and all these companies that are going to be hurting, they're going to start lobbying. And but I don't see a quick or easy solution here, because once the EU has instituted those tariffs, then of course we will have an impact. And now China has retaliated, and I think it will just continue like this.
Johan, you used two very painful words that I haven't heard in 4 years: trade war. This is obviously going to be something that is going to be around for quite some time. I mean, I think back to when it happened with China and the US and how significant that back and forth was. And the US is a much bigger economy than the EU.
Yes, absolutely. So I think we're going to see more of this, especially if Trump should win the US elections. He's already said he's going to raise tariffs significantly on Chinese imports into the US, but also EU imports into the US. So I think we're in for a bout of bad news for the global economy if this should escalate, and if Trump actually wins the US presidential elections, then it's another round of the same that we've seen before. And I'm fearful that it might be worse this time around.
When we look at that picture, who comes out the big winner, Johan? Who comes out the big loser in a global trade war where everybody's imposing tariffs on everybody else, and the three kind of major economies being the EU, the Chinese economy, and the US economies are all at war with each other. Who survives?
Yeah, I think I'm hoping that sanity will prevail and that World Trade Organization will step in at some point, and that. But sometimes you have to see the pain before you see the reaction, and I think the U.S. consumer will likely suffer the most. Trump's policies regarding immigration, limiting immigration, will limit labor supply, that will drive up wage and salary growth in the U.S. His policy around tariffs will raise consumer goods prices for U.S. consumers. Both of those will lift inflation. That will likely limit the extent to which we currently expect the Fed to cut rates. So that's bad for the U.S., but it's also bad for emerging markets like South Africa, because if the Fed is not cutting to the same extent, then the dollar is not unlikely to weaken to the same extent that we expect, and thus a currency like the rand might not strengthen to the same extent. So there's a whole bunch of influences that flows into the rest of the world. But I think the first big pain will be for the U.S. consumers, because their consumer prices. And I don't think that Trump's supporters actually understand that higher tariffs will mean higher prices and higher inflation. I don't know if Trump himself understands.
I suppose that could be a we'll deal with that situation later, or the fact that they survived it the first time, there's an element of confidence that they might be able to survive it again. Johan, when we look at someone like an LVMH whose share price was down today, and we know that they've kind of gone the route of taking up a stake in a company like Moncler that does fashion, yes, the one side of the trade war at the moment from China is on the brandy space in particular here, but China's got a huge amount of luxury that it consumes. This could potentially be a very, very dangerous time for European luxury companies like LVMH if this isn't dealt with.
Yes, absolutely, and especially perhaps at a time when these luxury goods companies have been seeing some light at the end of the tunnel, because post-COVID, there's been a long time when they've actually been suffering. The Chinese economy hasn't been pumping on all cylinders as it used to, but now that the Chinese have been stimulating the economy more, there was this hope that these luxury goods companies will actually recover some of that lost share in terms of selling their goods and services towards China. And now this. So I think it's particularly bad timing that when they thought things would start to recover, it actually might not. But in the end, I think there will be more losers than winners in a trade war, especially if that escalates across the world.
Johan, from an emerging market perspective, South Africa kind of sits on the sidelines in these sorts of events. We're mostly a consumer from all these other economies, and in some cases we export into these economies. Do we sit back and kind of wait and see what happens? Do we hedge our bets and try and find new markets to be able to prepare ourselves in the event that this does not de-escalate? And if so, are there even new markets that we can look at?
Yeah, that's the difficult part. When you were busy talking and asking that question, I was thinking, and I can't think of any new markets as such. So in the end, because we're such a small and open economy, there's very little that we can actually do. The best that we can try is boost our own local economy, reduce the structural problems that we've still got. We've done great with the electricity issue. Now we need to sort out all the others, like logistics, water supply, municipal failure, etc. So we must just, I think, refocus internally in terms of getting our own economy off the ground towards better growth, get a better environment where employment growth can bring better incomes for consumers, etc. But in terms of external markets, we must perhaps just sit back, do the best we can, but I don't think there's anything particularly strong that we can do to mitigate in terms of that. We must just become more productive so that we can make our products as cheap and competitive as possible on overseas markets. In the shorter term, there's very little we can actually do.
Hopefully sanity prevails. That is the message from Chief Economist at Old Mutual, Johan Els, around the escalating developments in the trade war or the tariff war that we're now seeing China get involved in with Europe. Thank you so much, Johan, for that, for those insights and for the time.
Hello, Jeremy Maggs here. I've just finished recording the next episode of Fix SA here on MoneyWeb. I'm in conversation with Ketso Gordon, who's the Chief Executive Officer of the South African SME Fund. Among the topics of conversation, why small businesses need to be paid in 30 days, the art of blended financing, and why scalability is not necessarily important in small businesses.
Join me, Jeremy Maggs, and South Africa's top leaders on the fortnightly MoneyWeb Fix SA podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Some companies are having a little bit of a difficult time getting things back on track, and we're taking a look at why this is and potentially what it means for those companies. I'm joined on the line by editor at My Broadband, Jan Vermeulen, to take a look at the technical insolvency that exists within Cell C, MultiChoice, and potentially even the Post Office, if we have time. Good evening, Jan. Thanks so much for the time. Always lovely to chat to you. I understand a technical recession. What is technical insolvency? I thought you were just insolvent.
So it's called technical insolvency because on your balance, your liabilities exceed your assets. But that could be for various reasons and doesn't necessarily mean that it's over for you, but it's certainly a warning sign, a huge red flag.
What happens if that warning sign isn't dealt with, Jan? What are the kind of the next steps? Is this where we start to look at things like bankruptcy and liquidation and all of those things?
Yeah, so in South African terms, you're looking at business rescue and potentially liquidation, bankruptcy, colloquially. So the Post Office, for example, is now in business rescue, but it was under provisional liquidation until the government offered over 6 billion rand bailout to get it essentially put into business rescue.
I suppose it does come in handy as the Post Office to have a shareholder that can do that from a bailout perspective. Then the term technical insolvency does kind of fall away. You have a bit of a cash pool you can dip into. Whether or not that's sustainable or not is another story. Jan, let's look at the case of Cell C. Is there hope for Cell C? What's happening there? I mean, that balance sheet's been under pressure for the longest time.
Yes, so there's encouraging signs at Cell C. So firstly, its negative equity has decreased year on year. And so it certainly looks like the management team there has a handle on things. They are working to ensure, you know, that things don't spiral completely out of control. But it's touch and go. I'm not gonna sugarcoat it. There's the Cell C and the CEO there, George Mendes, has made promises about, you know, huge plans that they've got to turn it around. But, there's talk about like market shaking products and all kinds of stuff that have to still materialize. And so until Cell C can do something about its declining revenue and its profitability, the problem isn't going to go away, and so there's good signs, but I'm not seeing anything yet to say, okay, no, it's going to pull out of this tailspin. It's still in a tailspin. There's still hope, but until we see something more concrete happening there than a rebrand, then I'm not comfortable to say whether it's there's hope or not. It's all in the hands of the management team, but that's not entirely true. There's also a fair amount of luck that's going to come into play here now as well.
Jan, what do you do as the parent company? As Blue Label Telecoms, you're the listed company, your subsidiary or one of your portfolio companies is not doing well, and you don't have the deep pockets that the state has to be bailing out the post offices of the world. What do you do as the parent looking at your subsidiary in this case?
Cut costs is one thing, but that's dangerous because if you cut too much, then you undermine the ability of the business to compete. In Celsius' case, what they've done is completely relook the strategy. And so they've gone, okay, you know what? You know, while it would be really nice to have a mobile operator that's trying to go toe-to-toe with Vodacom and MTN, that's unrealistic. Vodacom and MTN are pumping $10 billion a year each into their networks in capital expenditure just in South Africa. Then on top of that, they've also got sizable international operations on the rest of the continent. So, you know, what's realistic for Cell C? And so they've instead made deals with their competitors, Vodacom and MTN, around radio access network sharing. And so rather than building out their own cellular network, they've shut down their cellular network and are essentially outsourcing that function to MTN and Vodacom. So, you know, that has benefits and drawbacks, but the main benefit is that, yeah, you've kept your costs contained now. You are no longer trying to chase a ghost, you know, the ghost of I'm going to try to build a network as good as MTN's and Vodacom's. And you benefit from all of the investment that they've put in. So, but, you know, that comes at a price. And so, you know, you look at changes in strategy like that. But now, yeah, as I said, the next step is to come to market with a compelling product to make people go, hey, maybe I should give Cell C another try. Let me switch away from where I'm comfortable, Vodacom or MTN or Telkom, to give them another try. And that's going to be hard.
I remember a conversation with George Mendes around that strategy, quite a bold approach that they've decided to take to get rid of their infrastructure and leverage off of their competitors. Jan, let's move to MultiChoice. I want to look at them quickly. They have a couple of things going on. They're selling off their insurance business, or at least 60% of that insurance business, cleaning up that balance sheet. But they're also technically insolvent at this stage. Is this likely to be a concern for Canal Plus, because they've also been buying up a lot more shares in MultiChoice? We know that deal is kind of still going through. If you're a potential parent company or an incoming parent company, how concerned are you about it at this stage, and does it even matter to you?
Yeah, it depends on what Canal Plus wants MultiChoice for. So if they aren't particularly concerned, I would be concerned, because it means that they really just want MultiChoice for the shell. And are planning to essentially get rid of everybody inside it. So that would concern if Canal Plus was not worried, that would concern me. I'm sure that Canal Plus is at least somewhat concerned about MultiChoice's losses, its swinging into technical insolvency, and MultiChoice selling a marginally profitable unit, which in this case is its insurance business, at least the majority stake in it, to cover working capital. Those are some huge red flags at MultiChoice. And this isn't me talking. This is me relaying the comments of three different analysts who have looked at these numbers. So yes, there's certainly huge concern at MultiChoice. It essentially bet the farm on an African economic miracle. There's just going to be this huge number of consumers on the African continent who are then going to choose Showmax and DStv streaming services as their preferred streaming platform over Netflix, over Disney, over everybody else who's competing here. Based on a local content strategy. If that strategy pays off, then MultiChoice and Canal Plus are in the pound seats. But if it doesn't, there's some rough times ahead for MultiChoice.
That's a really big bet, Jan, and I wonder how likely that bet is to pay off if we think about just the pricing issues that MultiChoice has had. I know you guys have put out some pricing comparatives with the South African market as well as the other markets for the DStv premium package, and in some cases it seems it's overpriced. Is MultiChoice facing more issues than it can handle, understanding that it's lost subscribers as well, even though it's seen a bit of an increase in the streaming subscribers?
It's got its back to the wall, for sure. Besides the fact that, I mean, MultiChoice still has the killer live sports offering in South Africa and potentially on the continent. And so that's its trump card, is its dominance in live sports. But besides the fact that the South African consumer is under tremendous pressure and looking for places to save money, there's just an onslaught of competition for people's video entertainment now. You know, where MultiChoice used to be the only choice for premium video entertainment in South Africa, it's currently the only choice if you want, live sports. But when it comes to the best TV shows and movies, there's now some stiff competition out there. It still has some great stuff on there. It has a good selection of locally produced stuff, but it's certainly not the only game in town anymore. We've got the likes of Netflix and Disney competing here, but also Netflix and Amazon, who have made local content. Now, Amazon has essentially shut down its local content production unit for now, but Netflix hasn't. Netflix is actually making stuff locally here in South Africa. And plus Amazon is buying local stuff to put on its platforms. So MultiChoice faces this onslaught of competition. So it's a huge amount of challenges to deal with all at the same time. And really, it's going to be contingent on, did they select the right strategy? Can they keep their costs contained? Can they hold on long enough for their strategy to bear fruit? They've got some very ambitious projections for Showmax's revenue and subscriber numbers and DStv subscriber numbers as well over the next 3 to 4 years. I don't know that they're realistic. Certainly, analysts I've read and listened to don't seem to think so. So it's going to come down to who's right at the end of the day. And if MultiChoice turns out to be right, it'll be a success story for the books. And if they turn out to be wrong, it'll be a cautionary tale for the books.
Certainly something you don't want to be getting wrong and something you don't want to be getting involved in if you can stay out of it. Thanks so much, Jan, as always, for the insights. That's Jan Vermeulen, editor at My Broadband, on the technical insolvency that is facing MultiChoice, the post office, as well as Cell C.
My name is Louis Nell, and I am co-host of a social media channel called GCrypt. I will be on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast with Kieran Ryan talking about crypto scams and improbable investment opportunities, often using cryptocurrency. Most importantly, we'll look at some modern trends in crypto scams and how to spot them. Make sure you tune in.
Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Speaking of crypto, Luno's made a big announcement today. They've partnered with Zapper on a new development within the South African landscape that'll hopefully make things more accessible for South Africans. I'm joined on the line by Business Development Manager at Luno, Taris Arnold, to take a look at this and try and make sense of it. Good evening, Taris. Thanks so much for taking the time. Tell us about the partnership.
Thanks so much for having me, Julian. Good evening to your listeners. It is really exciting, an exciting milestone in the crypto landscape. Luno, we've been a kind of steadfast part of the crypto space for over 10 years now, really looking at ways how we can allow South Africans to get the most out of cryptocurrency and digital assets. And Zapper have been around for even longer, working on the payment space and being leaders in that. So coming together was really exciting to kind of open the door to allow South Africans to get a lot more utility out of the cryptocurrency and bring cryptocurrency closer to every day.
When we look at this particular partnership, I mean, Zapper's reach is quite extensive, and it basically means that individuals and consumers in South Africa can buy everything from flight tickets to their groceries at Dis-Chem with crypto. How far has crypto come in South Africa, particularly understanding that Luno is one of the first organizations to be authorized as a crypto asset service provider, and we have been at the forefront of that kind of legislation in the global space as well.
Yes, I think working with BAPA is really was a huge unlock for us. They have over 31,000 merchants. They have an extremely wide range, from flights to the bill to donations to fuel. We knew we needed a partner that had that real deep understanding of the market on the payment side, and where we could bring our crypto expertise in. We've seen a lot of demand from our customers trying to find ways to use their cryptocurrency more than they have in the past. And for a long time, it's been really, really limited. But fortunately, in the last year, we've been working with people like Zappa to really unlock the merchant database and unlock the spaces. And it is really driven by the legislation that we're seeing. Cryptocurrency service providers, crypto asset service providers becoming regulated and licensed this year has really increased confidence from institutional and business customers, and we're seeing a lot of adoption and excitement on that side.
Taris, let's look at this partnership with Zappa. The increased activity you guys are going to be able to do, is that going to be limited in any way? I mean, I'm thinking about things like transaction limits or transaction volumes. Can someone buy a car with crypto now?
So people can buy cars with crypto, but unfortunately not yet with Luna and Zappa. At the moment, the transaction limit is about 100,000 Rand, which is significantly increased from our previous limit of about 10,000. And that really comes with us developing stronger infrastructure and stronger controls to protect our customers and the merchants, and being able to use Zappa's expertise in that case. So this really, I think, is important to share that this is really a first step to building out cryptocurrency as a common kind of payment method, as a better way to trade with one another. And this is the first step. So while you may not be able to buy a house straight from a Luno app, it's definitely something that we dream to work towards.
What do we do to take the next steps? And what do those next steps look like? I mean, clearly the adoption of crypto will happen over time. And South Africa finds itself in a unique position where our regulator has legislated how they want to treat it, which therefore means that we can actually get ahead of other countries, whether on the African continent or around the world, in adopting this kind of new way of doing things. What do the next steps look like?
So South Africa already is quite a leader from adoption, from a legislative, from a product perspective in the cryptocurrency space, but we're still in the early days. An important next step is really getting the wider public more familiar with cryptocurrency, getting rid of some of the negative myths and assumptions that it's just all about kind of gambling and throwing money in and hoping it goes up, that cryptocurrency as an asset class and as a use case has so many broad uses, from the investment, from supporting institutional trade, from helping people buy just their daily bread. So what we're trying to do, particularly with this partnership, is really start bringing cryptocurrency closer to people in their everyday life, making people a lot more familiar with it as an asset class. And like you said, just leveraging off of the clarity we do have from the regulators and legislation now, to start building out better frameworks, better building blocks to really unlock the different use cases that cryptocurrency can deliver.
Taris, when we think about the use cases and just this particular partnership with Zappa, are there specific cryptocurrencies that are going to be limited here? I mean, we've touched on the limits from a financial or a monetary value perspective. Can clients use any crypto in their wallets to transact?
100%. The customers can use whatever crypto they have in their wallet. That was something that was really important for us. While certain cryptocurrencies are definitely more designed for the payment space, some of them aren't. And we want to give customers the flexibility that they can use the asset that they believe in. I think you'll see a lot of customers have real deep connections to a particular coin or a particular asset that they almost only want to use all the time. And others will have different motivations for which assets they hold. So having that flexibility of allowing our customers to pick and choose what is the best asset for them was incredibly important for us.
Taras, before I let you go, does this extend to international kind of transactions? Or are we solely looking at what Zappa has in South Africa? Or is this the start, as you said, of many more partnerships and collaborations that could extend beyond the borders of South Africa?
We always have to be careful about how cryptocurrency is used from South Africa and moving internationally, because we have to be considerate of things like exchange controls and the like. At the moment, this is definitely limited to South Africa only. I think that's really just a testament to South Africa is leading the way, where we can have the biggest crypto app partner with one of the biggest payment apps to unlock this huge functionality and utility to buy all kinds of things. So definitely the first step, and we'll be working with all kinds of different partners and different customers to see how we can bring the South African experience adoption and open up those rails and networks internationally with South Africa, leveraging the advantages of transparency, safety, security, low cost that come with cryptocurrency.
The dawn of a new era. Certainly some interesting times lie ahead, and we will keep an eye on these developments because they benefit the consumers at the end of the day. Thank you so much, Taras, for those insights. That's Taras Arnold, Business Development Manager at Luno, on their latest partnership with Zappa that will now let you use crypto wherever you see a Zappa sign.
And in your business news, Reserve Bank Governor, what's his name, has repeatedly said this and that, and policymakers are expecting rates to go up or down. With inflation somewhere between 0 and 100%, interest rate relief may come sooner or later. Who knows, really? The whatchamacallit slid into undefined territory based on the Duhigi being so-so, and the markets were hard to describe. Despite initial doubts, the outcome was a mixed bag. The rand was meh based on the US consumer prices, but sentiment towards the currency could be, you know, whatever.
You can't base a decision on imprecision. Ask your financial advisor about a guaranteed annuity from Momentum Wealth. Personalized certainty.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's Tuesday, it's Agri-Tuesday this week, and we're taking a look at a very interesting concern in the agricultural space, the halting of anti-venom production that has raised some serious concerns in the animal kingdom, I suppose. I'm joined on the line by the CEO of the African Snakebite Institute, Johan Moret, to take a look at this and try and understand it. Good evening, Johan. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start by understanding the particular anti-venom that has been halted in terms of production and its uses in everyday life in South Africa.
Thank you for the invite. It hasn't really halted. It just seems that the wheels have come off. So antivenom in South Africa, we have two regular snake antivenoms. We have a monovalent boomslang antivenom, and then we have a polyvalent antivenom that covers the venom of 10 snakes, most of the cobras, the adders, the runkels. And it is produced by the South African vaccine producers, which is part of the National Health Laboratories. And since COVID, there's been a dire shortage, and it appears at this stage that there is virtually no production and virtually no stock. Very difficult for us to get answers, but I have seen recent emails where they have said that they do not have stock. Now, the problem with the antivenom is that in a serious snake bite, it is the correct treatment for a human and for pet, especially dogs that get bitten very often because they're natural hunters. They see a snake and they want to kill it. And the veterinarians are finding it extremely difficult to obtain antivenom, and a lot of dogs are dying.
Johan, when we look at the production of the antivenom, is there a missing ingredient that's perhaps caused the production to slow down? What is the process like to manufacture the antivenom, and do we kind of know where the holdup is?
No, we're not sure where the holdup is. There has been excuses in the past. It's a long process. You basically take the venom of the 10 snakes and you inject it into a horse in very small quantities, just enough to trigger its immune system, not enough to harm the horse in any way. And week by week, you increase these dosages, and it takes the horse about 9 months to become immune to the snake venom. At that stage, you can draw about 9 liters of blood every second month, and the serum is removed from the blood, purified, and that pretty much as the anti-venom. So you're injecting patients with horse serum, and that horse serum finds the venom and neutralizes it. So if you have any problems in that 9-month process, you're going to have to start from scratch.
That sounds like a very complicated process. Johan, when we think about the number of people that are bitten by snakes, or the number of humans and pets, I suppose, that are bitten by snakes either every year or every month, how serious a problem does this become if we continue to not have anti-venom on the ready or on hand?
Yes, it's a disaster. You know, humans, we have about 10 to 12 snake bite fatalities a year. And in most of these cases, if you can hospitalize the patient very early on, soon after the bite, and provide the correct treatment, you can save a lot of lives. But that gives us no indication of the morbidity, because 9 out of 10 bites that we see are from snakes with cytotoxic venom that do tissue damage. And in a lot of these cases, the tissue damage is severe. And that means that you're going to have a patient in a hospital for months, various operations, disfigurement, potentially amputations. And by and large, in South Africa, as in many other African countries, snake bite is a poor man's disease. If you're a rural farmer working barefoot in the field, you're exposed. Your risk of a bite is infinitely higher. And more often than not, you're very far away from the nearest hospital. That's the one part of the problem. Far more dogs get bitten by snakes, because snakes end up in suburban gardens. The dogs tackle them. And these are people's pets. And they end up at a vet, and the vet does not have anti-venom. And in any serious bite, there's a likelihood that that dog will die.
Johan, is there an alternative solution here? Something like importing the venom in the meantime? Is that even an option? I mean, the process you outlined earlier on around how the venom is manufactured seems very complicated and quite lengthy. And as you said, any disruptions to that cause a greater problem than having to just get that. Can we get the venom elsewhere?
Yes, there is a solution. There is a product called Pan African Premium that comes in from India. It has World Health Organization approval. It's distributed in South Africa. But because it's not a registered drug here, you have to apply to purchase it under Section 21 of SAHPRA, which means that you have to do a fair amount of paperwork to be able to access this antivenom. The second problem is that it costs per vial about the same as the local antivenom, just over 2,000 rand a vial. So in humans with polyvalent antivenom, you're going to need 6 vials for a start. With a Pan-African problem, you need double the dosage. So you're looking at double the cost. So for a mama bite, for instance, you'll start with, let's say, 12 vials. You're looking at about close on 30,000 rand. But with a Pan-African product, you're looking at about 60,000 rand just for the antivenom and not for the treatment.
Johan, as the African Snakebite Institute, your role, I mean, obviously, aside from keeping South Africans, consumers and citizens informed around these things, is also the protection of whether it's snake species or human species alike. Is there kind of a way that individuals can safeguard themselves? Are there immediate dangers in that respect, or are we kind of still safe at the moment?
Yes, we're safe at the moment. The major hospitals do have stock. Some of the private hospitals have started stocking the imported product. But I think it's important for people to take basic precautions. Snakes bite in desperation. When you stand on them, or when you accidentally corner them, if you try and kill them, that's when they bite. So our recommendation is that, especially at night, people should try and use torches. A lot of people get bitten when they accidentally stand on snakes. As for snakes in gardens, they're attracted by rodents and they're attracted by frogs. So if you have water features, you can attract the frogs. If you have dog food lying around, bird aviaries with seeds around, you attract the rodents, and that brings the snakes in. So keep your property clean. And the moment you see an abundance of rodents, which most people don't see because they're sitting watching television or doing whatever they do indoors and they don't know what's going on outdoors, but keep an eye out for that. You have rodents around, you're going to attract snakes.
Certainly some very interesting insights and things to be aware of, especially when you take your next trip around your garden. We'll leave it at that, Johan. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights, and especially for the alert. That's Johan Mare, who is the CEO of the African Snakebite Institute, on the shortage of anti-venom that is currently in the market and how you can stay safe.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha. on SAFM.
The Property Pod.
Human Settlements Minister Mamoloko Kubai recently mentioned plans by government to look at changing the law to force banks to explain rejection of home loans to anyone from previously disadvantaged backgrounds. Kubai's comments raised the ire of the Banking Association as well as other organizations like Sentinel Homes. On the Property Pod this week, the CEO of Sentinel Homes, Rainier Crick, weighs in on the issue.
The Property Pod.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
We've come to the end of our show, folks. Thanks for tuning in. If you've missed any of our conversations, they're up online. We put them everywhere. It's just gone 7 o'clock. Greg Hose is standing by with the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the top sport team. From my side, good night.